Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, May 12th, 2023. We're having rainy weather here in Nashville today, and the garden is loving it. Thank you to Ron Trammell for our bluesy intro music. It's been several weeks since I've posted an interview. We were finally able to do our trip to England, which had been canceled a couple years ago due to the pandemic. And of course, upon our return, we tested positive for COVID. So now we are recovered and we're back in the saddle, so to speak. Thank you to modern medicine. At the outset today, I want to give a shout out to the various naturalists I have interviewed in the last 5 years of this podcast. And there have been quite a few. Gail Eichelberger, Jennifer Bauer, Bobby Fulcher, Doug Talamay, Joe Prosciutto, Laura Cook, Alan Coggins, Connie Deegan, Kristen Hopkins, really an all-star lineup of experts from state government and local government with some thoughtful things to say. I hope you will take the time to peruse our archives and listen to their various interviews. The fun part for me is that I keep meeting more energetic and talented people. Yesterday, I sat down with Holly Taylor, who serves as the Assistant State Naturalist for Tennessee within the Tennessee State Park System. Together with her boss, Randy Hedgepath, Holly works on a statewide basis, offering programs directly to the public and also providing training for others, parks, seasonal, and full-time staff. She is also a valued expert when it comes to resource management of the parks. Today we talk about the spring bird migration, which is right now at its peak here in Tennessee, as well as programs available to citizens who desire to dig in a little deeper to develop their knowledge of nature in Tennessee. And so I hope you'll enjoy my chat with Holly Taylor. And we will get started right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish 6 beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
So, Holly Taylor, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Holly, it's great to kind of meet you in person. As we were talking before we got started, I've been following you and your and what you've been up to on Facebook and on your blog and other things. You have the auspicious title of Assistant State Naturalist. And I want to talk about what that entails. I sort of have a notion of what it means, but I want my audience to hear from you about it. And you follow in a long line of folks that have been friends and acquaintances of mine over the years. I guess Mac Pritchard, Randy Hedgepath are the prominent ones. And we were talking before we got on the air about Alan Coggins. And Alan has been a guest on this program before. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Holly, in the sense of, are you from Tennessee? Did you go to school here? How did you get interested in parks and natural history and all that sort of thing? Tell us about all that.
Sure. I mean, it definitely started at a very early age. I could remember, well, the earliest I could remember, all I wanted to do was be outside. I've always loved nature and the outdoors, always had a soft spot for the creepy crawlies and the things that other people didn't like. So I always had to try to figure out, okay, why don't you like this? Why don't you like snakes? What's the matter with you? And I loved being able to share those things with other people. That was a really early trait of mine. I remember getting a rock out of the driveway and taking it to school for share and tell or show and tell. And I was getting everyone excited about it. A rock.
Out of a the rock.
That was me. I don't know. And that's still me, I guess. And then I guess fast forward and, well, I guess I could talk about the way I was raised.
Yeah, where were you? Where did you grow up?
Tennessee. Yeah, I'm born and raised in Tennessee.
Okay.
I've actually not moved too far, to be honest. I grew up in the Cookeville area.
Okay, and, Upper Cumberland area. Okay.
Yeah, so still, I'm still in Middle Tennessee. You know, I've gotten around some, been out of the country a couple of times, but I do love Tennessee a lot. I had parents that were hippies, so we spent a lot of time outside camping, and they were big lovers of nature, so a big influence there. And then college, I got a degree in conservation biology. I was sort of touched on a lot of different topics related to the natural world, conservation, and that sort of thing. And then actually got my first job with state parks in 2006. I was working as a seasonal interpretive ranger for Edgar Evans State Park. And I worked for six consecutive seasons there. That's where I met my now husband. We've been married since 2007. And I wasn't, then, well, I took a break for a while. We had our son in 2013. And I stepped away from parks for a while, and then I got asked back in 2018 by Randy to assist him. And that's kind of fast forward to today, and that's where we are.
So you're a product of Tennessee Tech, is that, am I right about that? Okay.
Yep.
You know, I always ask about that because young people want to know about these career paths and how people get into parks. And
right.
And it's become kind of a subject that comes up often on this program about the seasonal interpretive specialists and seasonal recreators and those people that get jobs while they're in school or otherwise, and it gives park leadership a chance to observe people and see how quickly they learn and how they deal with other people and accept supervision and criticism and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's the career path that so many of the people I've talked to, I mean, even Mac Pritchard that we spoke about earlier, worked as a seasonal at Meeman Shelby years ago. I have to laugh. You talk about picking up a rock and doing an interpretive program. And that's the kind of thing that Mac would do.
Yep.
He would pick up a rock and all of a sudden he's doing flint, demonstrating how the Indians did made flint arrowheads and stuff. Mm-hmm. So you are now the assistant state naturalist and you're assistant to Randy Hedgepath.
Yes.
And tell us what you do every day in your job. I know it's different every day, but what are the kinds of things that you do?
It is very different every day. And I do like that because admittedly I do get bored easily. So, so I guess broadly what I do is assist Randy Hedgepath with his programs and events. There's a lot of things that we collaborate on event wise. And then we do a lot of things separately, but we both work, the department that we work in state parks is under the Interpretive Programs and Education, or IP&E. And so we do a lot of things in the field, in parks and natural areas and state lands, but we also do a lot of behind the scenes support for field staff, which is mostly park rangers, assisting with trainings, just gathering together materials, like on SharePoint, that sort of thing. We also help with junior ranger camps, occasionally do tours. And then, of course, the Tennessee Naturalist Program is another big part of what we both do. But.
Right. And I want to get into the Tennessee Naturalist Program because that's an intriguing thing. And I think people want to hear about it. You know, I see all the time that Randy and yourself are leading hikes.
Yes.
And in fact, most recently, I saw you were leading a hike at the Elsie Quarterman Wildflower Pilgrimage, which was just last weekend at Cedars. You did a hike in of a cedar glade, I guess.
Yeah.
And so How does the average citizen out there listening to this program become aware of those kind of opportunities to participate with you and Randy and in the programs that you're up to?
So for the most part, those programs are going to be up on the State Parks calendar. If you go to the Tennessee State Parks webpage, you can look up upcoming events. You can even search by park on there if you want to. And that's a good way to see what sort of events are coming up. We don't really have, like, I don't guess the calendar is specific to what Randy and I are doing all the time. If we are both on Facebook, if you follow us on social media, we'll put, hey, we got this coming up, and you can join us if you want to. But anything that's going to be taking place in a state park or natural area should be up on the calendar. So that's probably the best.
Gotcha. And of course, I guess it's true that if people have a particular interest, they can contact you directly.
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. Yeah. And the best way to do that, either you or Randy, is how?
Email. I would say email.
Okay.
Sure.
Or Facebook Messenger or something
yeah, that
like that.
Too. Yeah, okay. I'll answer on Facebook too.
Okay. Well, you know, just the other day, Holly, and I have to tell you, you have a blog, and I don't know how often you actually post things to your blog, but I've read your blog, and encourage anybody that really wants to do a deep dive, that there's a place to look. You have done some remarkable observations about birding in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. You may consider that a specialty. I don't know, but from my viewpoint, I'm solidly impressed with what you're doing as far as birding is concerned.
Thank you.
In one of the recent blogs, you did kind of a summary of the bird activities almost park by park across mm-hmm. the state. Am I right about that? I mean,
you are exactly
yeah,
right.
Because it was kind of lengthy, and very detailed. But at the same time, it was extraordinarily impressive. So is birding a specialty of yours, or is there just a special interest, or tell us more.
I would say it's probably become a specialty. I mean, it's kind of a specialized, I guess, hobby or area of interest anyways. It's not, I mean, I guess you can be a casual birder, but I can safely say I'm a big bird nerd. I've been birding now probably for about 15 years. And it's funny, you mentioned about the park by park with the birding data. One of my projects that I've been working on, because we've been trying to sort of consolidate biotic information for our parks and natural areas on SharePoint, which is a big thing we're working on right now. It's mostly for the field, but so I've been consolidating data from eBird.org for all the individual parks, and I've got a list that I update in real time for the different parks. That's why I watch that so closely. And I put that blog post together just to kind of highlight, you know, what's going on in the parks regarding birding.
So you keep a list, or there is a list that exists for each park
yes.
of birds that have been observed there.
Yes. They're not public yet. Right now they're just for the field. I mean, you can go on eBird anytime and look up the parks. They're what we call hotspots on there. But I've been consolidating data that's not just on the hotspots. Eventually, we're going to work on some things that can be distributed to the public as well. People can ask me if they're interested.
Sure,
and observe there.
It's not secret information.
No, it's yeah, not. It's right, just that yeah. We're just not to the point now where it's gone, you know, public. But
there's some organization that has to take place to make things public. That
yeah.
You know, there has to be. It has to be organized in a way to handle that. But and so these are observations of birds made by professionals or also from amateurs?
Both.
Okay.
That's what eBird is for anybody who wants to observe. We have everything from some of the top birders in the world to people that are just, you know, casual backyard birders. It's a hobby. So eBird is for everybody.
Okay.
There are checks and balances on there, especially for those that are unsure or, you know, are new to birding. And so you have what are known as regional reviewers that'll sort of review.
I see. So I see.
So there is a, you know, certain amount of, like I said, checks and balances involved with that data. So,
well, you know, birding is a topic that people should be talking about today in this season in Tennessee. I noticed you posted the other day about the spring migration that's going on. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. We did a program about that, about the fall migration back in the fall of this year with folks here in Nashville that were from Warner Park, the Bird Project at Warner Park. Mm-hmm. And so, and their efforts to keep people, have people turn their lights out at night,
right,
because of the migrations. But tell us what's going on for those that may not know about that spring migration. What's going on?
Right. So we're probably, Tennessee is probably hitting its peak right now for spring migration. There are a lot of species we call neotropical migrants. Of course, those are primarily ones that are flying from south of the equator, but there's a great number of species that winter in South America and Central America, and then they come up here in the temperate areas to breed. And then you have the reverse in the fall, those birds go back down to those areas. One place actually that you can keep track of that is BirdCast, which is a new tool that's been developed by Cornell Labs. And really a lot of that's based on the eBird data, which, all, by the way, all of that data that goes into eBird isn't just, you know, it's not just sitting there. It's being used by ornithologists and researchers. And so one of the things they can track are those bird migrations. And you can actually, well, they can actually see them on weather radar. And so that's where they're getting that information. You can look at a three-day forecast or bird cast and see, you know, how many birds are migrating. But you mentioned turning off the lights. And the reason you do that is because the majority of them are actually migrating at night.
Right.
Under the cover of darkness, and we're not really aware of it, but they really depend on dark skies to help them navigate. And so those bright, bright lights can interfere with their navigation at night. So that's why we recommend turning out your lights.
You know, so that particular application or computer program that you're referencing, mm-hmm. my recollection is that you just put your zip code in.
You can.
And then it will give you kind of a dashboard, and tell you, you know, the numbers, the volume of birds that may be passing through your way, and even the types of birds, mm-hmm. and you know, it's it presents an opportunity for people that are interested in the early morning when these birds have been flying all night. They will often settle into a neighborhood or a wooded area to feed through the day. And you can often make observations of really unusual birds at that time of the day. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. The spring migration is especially exciting because they're in their breeding plumage. And so some of these warblers, especially the males, are just absolutely breathtaking. And so if you can get out in the mornings, really, most of the day, like, you can catch them, out and about if you're patient, you'll see them moving around because they don't, birds actually sort of sleep a little bit and they get active and sleep a little bit. But they have to fuel up during the day. So they're usually in your yards or in these wooded areas, collecting insects as their fuel, to go north. And so, especially if you have a lot of good, like, native trees and shrubs and plants, you're going to have a lot of birds there feeding. I was thinking about Radnor Lake. Probably that's one of the top places to bird in the Nashville area, just because you have sort of this island of natural area surrounded by a sea of development. And so it compresses all those birds in. And so people make the most incredible observations. And those birds are so used to all the activity because there's always a lot of people there. And so you oftentimes get some incredible looks at some of the rarest warblers that move through. So,
you know, and there's a program called Merlin,
yes,
which is so much fun. I often will come out with my coffee in the morning and sit on the patio and just turn that on and see what birds. And it identifies the birds that are present based on the sounds that they're making. and a database that they have to compare and suggest to you what you're listening to. Fascinating. And a free application. So people listening, Merlin, it's also Cornell Lab, I think. Is that right?
Cornell, eBird and Birdcast, all of those are Cornell. Merlin's a lot of fun. We've had some fun with it too. It's a good aid, but we do caution people not to rely on it 100%.
Okay.
if they're reporting like actual sightings of birds, it does tend to misidentify. It tends to give false positives for a lot of rare species sometimes. But it's a great way, just a sort of additional tool to have in your pocket. Like, here's that. Let's see if we can find that. You know, just kind of use it that way. But it has been helpful for me even. I mean, one place I struggle with birding, especially over the wintertime with the sparrows, are the call notes. They're not singing. They make these little chips and things. And it actually, it was pretty accurate for that and actually helped me. So it's a cool app, I do have to say.
Okay, well, there we go. Now we've done the birding
thing. Talk about that all day. So you may
I encourage people to friend you on Facebook and follow what you do in birding, because you'll learn something, and I learn something all the time, because you're doing a lot of observations around Middle Tennessee and up Center Hill Lake and those environs, and that's a very wooded area, and so there's lots of shelter there for the birds, and you're seeing I guess and around your home too, to some degree, and you're seeing a lot of rare birds. And I guess they're you know, I'm sitting about 2 miles from Radnor, and it's wooded here between there and my house, but we don't see nearly the rare birds that they do. So, all right, so let's talk about the Tennessee Naturalist Program. I have several friends that have participated in that program, generally speaking, this is a place where adult people that are interested in digging in a little deeper into natural history and biology, botany, that sort of thing. It's an opportunity to get some actual training and education on that subject. So, with that sort of general introduction to what it is, tell us more particularly, be more precise about it.
Of course. Yeah, the Tennessee Naturalist Program is basically our master naturalist program, if you will. I know several states have those. Of course, ours is unique to Tennessee. And I'm actually the coordinator of one of those chapters based out of Cumberland Mountains State Park. There are currently 12 chapters statewide.
Okay.
I think the long-term goal is to have 15 chapters so that, you know, anyone will have a chapter close to them where they can take this program.
Now, is there an overall, who was the coordinator of the whole thing overall, or is there one?
Yeah, so it's a nonprofit organization. There's a lot of partners. It's mostly run by volunteers. In fact, Mac Pritchard was on the board of one of the founding members of the board when it was this. He was actually a big proponent of it.
And the organization is known as
the Tennessee Naturalist Program.
Okay, all right. So it's its own entity. All right.
It is, absolutely.
All right. Okay.
And I think it was the early 2000s, if I remember correctly, when it really came into being. And I think Owls Hill was the first chapter for that. So the chapter that I coordinate is based out of Cumberland Mountain State Park. There's only, I think, two or three other chapters that are based out of state parks. A lot of them are based out of like nature centers and that kind of thing, run by volunteers. But as far as the format of it, it basically there's 40 hours of class time.
Okay.
And it's divided into usually 10 subjects, 10 individual classes. And each individual class is 4 hours. Two of those hours are typically spent like in-class lecture or lab, and then 2 hours spent in the field. And that's sort of the basic format of the classes themselves. We bring in guest instructors. Sometimes they are other park rangers or people that are experts in the field. We always try to make sure that they're really fun and engaging. And then once you complete the classes to get your full certification, if you want to be a certified Tennessee naturalist, then you do have to complete 40 hours of volunteer service.
Okay.
I think the time now, it used to be strictly like 1 year to get it completed, but they've given a little more wiggle room since COVID. So I think they're saying maybe 2 years now to complete that and get your certification. And it looks really good on a resume. We've had a lot of students take it, or people that are interested in getting a job in the field. It's something that I would like to take, but I can't take it because I'm always teaching it and I'm always coordinating it. But
sure.
Which I don't, I really love it. It's a lot of fun, but and it looks different depending on the chapter. Like there's a lot of, I guess, diversity in how they conduct the classes. Sometimes it may be like one or two classes per month stretched out over the course of a year.
Oh, I see. I see.
And then some, like ours is really unique. Ours was actually set up to be a compressed or an expedited course so that we typically meet the last 3 weeks of April, Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and have as many as two classes a day. So it's a little intense.
So like 4 hours of classroom in a day.
Yeah. So it could be as much as 8 hours, actually.
Oh, my. Yes. Okay. I see.
It's four hours per class. So I think I've decided next year I'm going to do at least one class a day format and just kind of scale it back a little bit. So ours is really unique in that respect for people that happen to work weekends or, they're interested in getting it, done in a quick amount of time. We had to do it that way just because we work weekends. We usually have other obligations on the weekends, and we're more free during the week to devote ourselves to it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So, and there's a surprising number of people that prefer weekdays. You would expect just people who are retired, but we've actually had a lot of people, if they know ahead of time, they can schedule off work. There's people that work for them. So there's a diversity of people that do take it. And I really enjoy it. It's very fulfilling. And it's really sort of the main purpose behind the Tennessee Naturalist program. It's not just so you learn stuff, which is great. It's a good part of it. We're really hoping to cultivate people who, will move forward and, take care of our parks. They're going to be active members of their communities. And, the word I'm looking for is escaping me right now. It'll come to me later, but it doesn't matter anymore. But just people who who care about parks, and we'll move forward and pay it forward, I guess, is what we're meant.
Well, there's only so many people that can be park rangers and park naturalists, and
right. And
there's way more work to do than the folks that do it for a living can do.
Absolutely.
Years ago, there was a fellow by the name of Herb Lester, who was the county ag agent here in Davidson County. And he would get phone calls during gardening season from people setting out gardens for the first time about how to do a soil test and all the things you do when you garden. And he decided to start the Master Gardeners program to train up some people that could help answer some of those calls so that he would be free to spend his time on more important things. Is that part of the idea too, for you guys to have other people that you can refer to do programming and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean that is something. Steward is the word I'm looking for.
We're steward. Yeah.
Stewardship. And that's a big part of why we require the volunteer service. It's not just to make you work, but it helps you sort of get involved. And a lot of them, they conduct their volunteer hours at state parks. There's a huge need for volunteer service in the parks because, there are so many park rangers and they have very little time to devote to that. And so it's a big help for the parks. Of course, they can complete their volunteer hours in any number of ways. It doesn't just have to be at state parks. But, it's meant to be a launching point, not just a beginning and an end. They're meant to continue, get a taste of, the natural world and what Tennessee has to offer and just keep moving forward with it.
So you have this program at Cumberland Mountain in Crossville, mm-hmm. And you mentioned that there were other state parks that were hosts for these as well?
Yes. So there is one chapter based out of Long Hunter State Park.
Okay.
South Cumberland State Park has a chapter. That one's run by primarily their Friends group, Friends of South Cumberland. And then Paris Landing State Park.
Oh, okay.
Actually has that. Theirs is newer. They actually partner with the Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge. They have it.
Oh, very cool.
Really awesome chapter.
Very cool.
So, like I said, every chapter is very different. There's one, is it called Discovery? There's a place up close to Real Foot. Is it called Discovery Park? Or
I don't know about.
Anyway, there's one up there. Maybe I'm thinking of the one in Chattanooga, but.
Yeah, that would be Reflection Riding, I presume, in Chattanooga.
Maybe.
The Chattanooga
Audubon Acres.
Okay.
That's the one.
Right.
So we're still wanting to fill in some gaps. There's still a big gap in West Tennessee that we're hoping to get some new chapters in there. So.
You know, it occurs to me to ask you about your the relationship that you have and Randy and the State Naturalist Program have with our school systems and overall in Tennessee. Of course, we've got a lot of county school systems, city school systems, private schools. Tell us about your relationships with the schools and how does that work out?
Well, we do a school program. Occasionally we do school programs. I would say that probably there's a lot of programs based out of our department that partner more with the education side of things. I know a lot of state parks are offering programs now that actually fulfill the curricula or the standards for classes.
In the natural science type area?
Yes. And so that's something that you can reach out to your local parks about, because most parks do offer those types of field trips and programs that will, you know, fulfill those needs. I think that overall that actually like the parks themselves and the rangers do more school programs than I think we do anymore. We're usually really, you know, tied up with other events and things like that. I love doing school programs, though. I mean, I actually spent, I forgot to mention this, but I spent 2 years working for, they're now Animology, but it used to be the Natural History Education Company of the Mid-South, and Bob Tarter, the Tarters are their names, and they do wildlife programs. They actually do a lot of programs in state park events as well. And I spent 2 years on the road doing their World of Reptiles program, and that was primarily at schools and libraries. And
now, who was this that you were working for? I'm sorry, I missed.
Bob Tarter was his name.
Okay.
But they call themselves Animology now.
Okay.
But they used to be the Natural
Animology. Yeah. Okay.
Animology, yeah. And but they're a business. They're a private.
And they offer programs for schools.
They do. For the summer reading programs.
Okay.
I've been kind of out of touch for a little while. But there used to be a grant you could apply for.
I see.
To have him come, but he has a different themed program every year that he does. I think his last one had to do with nocturnal animals, maybe.
Holly, years ago there was at Middle Tennessee State. Had a special focus on environmental education programs, and there was Project Learning Tree. I didn't know if you might know that that was something that still existed, but their role, they were, their whole mission was to interface with school systems across the state, mm-hmm. and to get this environmental ed program into the science curricula in the various schools. Mm-hmm. But that's not something that's going on now that you're aware of, or?
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. I guess I'll have to dig in and see if.
Yeah.
There was years ago, there was a division of educational services within the conservation department, and it had the Conservationist magazine and several other functions. But there was a fellow named Padgett Kelly, who was the last director of that. And he moved off to Middle Tennessee State as a faculty member and brought that program with him to that setting. I think I put that right. All right, so we just talked about the Tennessee Naturals program. Is there a cost involved in for people that want to do that? And tell us about that.
Yes, so it does cost, currently it costs $300 for the entire course, which I think breaks down to about $25, $30 per class. I think the price is going to have to start going up again just because they've had to hire, the organization has had to hire some additional, I think, administrators. Because it's grown so much, the cost is going up. But if you compare it to other states, we're actually still really kind of lowballing it when it comes to the Tennessee Naturalist program. But that is set by them.
Okay.
That's their prerogative. But
is there like a waiting list to get into this? You're shaking your head. Yes. Okay.
So now all of the registration is 100% through their website. So if you want to learn more about the program, go to tnnaturalist.org.
Okay.
And you can look up the individual chapters on there, pull them up, and you can see if registration is open, if they have any classes coming up, and then you can register from that link there, and it'll automatically put you on a waiting list if the class is full. So.
Holly, I wanted to change the subject just a little bit, and I'm looking at the setting that you're I'm looking at you behind the microphone there, and I see on your wall behind you is a poster of looks like bees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have an interest in the insect world as well.
Oh yeah.
And I saw just, I guess this morning, you posted somebody's picture of a firefly.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about your interest in the insects.
Yeah, so it all just kind of goes back to my love of creepy crawlies, my love for the underdogs and the things that I feel are underappreciated. Yes, I love creepy crawlies. I love native bees, especially. That's an area that's still really under researched, under appreciated. So I like to think of, you know, our native bees as the unsung heroes in many ways. And then fireflies are sort of the same way as well. We don't really know a lot, or generally don't know a lot about fireflies in Tennessee. And so that's one of my favorite things. So another thing that I do with my job, and this is just sort of, I take it upon myself when I'm usually visiting sites, like a park or natural area, species inventory. So I basically go around and try to identify and document as many species as I can. And occasionally it's a species that no one else has documented before because no one else is looking for these things. And one example would be there's a firefly. I don't even think it has a common name, but the genus name is Pleiotomus. And I found one, I've actually found several now, at Vestas Cedar Glade in Middle Tennessee. It's a state natural area. And I sent the sighting to Lynn Faust, who is the firefly expert in North America, basically. But she lives in Elkmont, Tennessee. She wrote the book, actually. Oh,
she lives up in the Smokies.
Yeah. This,
okay. This oh, my.
I've got it right here. I sent the sighting to her. And according to her records, I think it only been documented in Kentucky. At that point. And so, but I realized, okay, I've seen these at Edgar Evans too. So they're probably like all over Middle Tennessee. But it's just, no one's looking for these things. And most people don't realize we have at least 30 species of fireflies in Tennessee. And for most everyone, a firefly is a firefly. So I love shedding light on those types of things. They're such a fascinating group of animals. And then bees too, of course, because bees are so important. We've got over 350 species of bees in Tennessee, for example. So,
you know, the preaching to the choir here, you know, I have fireflies in my backyard every summer. And I think it's because I don't use pesticides in
right.
my yard. And I think that many children out there in Tennessee are not seeing fireflies as part of their childhood. Because somebody wants to have a perfect lawn. To me, that's a shame.
It is a shame. And we are seeing a worldwide decline in invertebrates and insect life. And fireflies are one of those that are in steep decline all across the world. Bees, of course, which is a huge issue all pollinators. And then we talked about birds earlier. You know, the right. steep decline in insects coincides directly with the decline in birds because birds need insects. So right. it's actually been described as an insect apocalypse at the rate that we're losing. I think in the last 75 years, we've lost about half of the insect biomass on the planet. That's huge. And you don't really think about that. People don't like bugs, you know, so that you don't really hear people getting up in arms about that. But it's anecdotal that people of the older generations, you don't notice as much having to clean your windshield off as much.
Exactly. Exactly.
You don't notice as many fireflies in your yard as you used to. So there's a lot of contributing factors to that. Of course, habitat loss is going to be a big one. And if we're talking about fireflies, they have to have leaf litter because most of the firefly larvae live in leaf litter. And so you leave the leaves. That's one of our mantras is leave the leaves if you can. And of course, no pesticides if you can avoid it. That's, you know, they're indiscriminate, so they're going to kill everything. And like everything else, you know, focus on planting native if you can. So many different insects and species rely on native plants. And you can, if you can start with any size, you know, if you've got a tiny yard, if you've got a balcony in the middle of a city, you can plant natives and it will make a difference for your local environment. So,
well, Holly, we had Doug Talamay as a guest on this program.
Lucky you.
Yeah, it was very lucky. It's been a 5 or 6 months ago. He was kind enough to spend an hour with me. And of course I'd read his books and all that kind of thing. But of course this is what he preaches, is that the bugs are the essential food for the birds. And if you're wanting to have birds in your yard and a variety of them, you can't just rely on a bird feeder, because the birds, when they're feeding their babies, are feeding them bugs and you know, particularly worms and that sort of thing. So, you're preaching the same sort of gospel that Doug Talamay. You need to have several best-selling books to go along with that,
right?
Holly.
I'm doing well to write a blog post every 4 times a year. I don't know if I could do a whole book.
Well, you could. I think you could probably do that.
One day. We'll see.
Well, Holly, you have some travels planned here and around the state here anytime soon, just for fun?
For fun? Well, work is fun. So
yeah, well, tell us about that.
Probably the next big thing coming up will be, this is our seasonal interpretive ranger training, which is a big annual thing where we bring in all of our new and past, not all our past seasonals, but we have, I think it's up to 2 or 3 years returning. But the big thing is for our first year SIRs. I don't remember how many, but it's a lot. We've had a really big response to this program, and we have a lot of people to train. So that'll be a week at Chickasaw State Park.
Okay.
Which it's a lot of fun. It's exhausting, but it's a lot of fun. That's probably the biggest thing coming up. And then after that, the last week of May, or the week before Memorial Day, is the Western Wallflower Week, which is an event at Edgar Evans State Park. And I won't be there for most of it because I actually will be at Chickasaw for a greater part of it. My husband will be leading these tours. There's some really rare wildflowers that grow on the bluffs over Center Hill Lake. So we do daily boat tours to go see those plants.
So boat tours to see the plants.
Yes.
Oh, that's cool. I was envisioning hiking around that snaky place. That is a snaky place up there around Center Hill.
A few snakes. There's actually the latest issue, The Conservationist, there's an article that I did about the wallflower tours.
Okay.
Check that out. That was actually my first full article for The Conservationist. So I've not read it yet because I know I'm going to find mistakes. But you can learn more about it in that article. It's a lot of fun. It's kind of risky to plan an annual event around the blooming of a flower because, you know, things bloom at different times. So far, this might be the year, but so far it's not let us down. It's been in bloom that week. But there's a lot of other really interesting plants that are found there and nowhere else in the world, basically. We always see a lot of birds and wildlife, and bonus, if it's hot, we will park the boat and you can swim.
Oh gosh, that's
It's
great.
a whole
That's
like
great.
3 day event. You can go, not event, but three hour
And
boat trip.
this is when on the calendar is this going to be?
The week before Memorial Day, I think
Okay.
the first date that he's got, that it's up on the calendar in May.
The latter part of May.
Yes,
Okay,
and
excellent.
those are up on the state parks website and also on their Facebook page.
Okay,
I can
and
link
probably
that.
on the Edgar Evans
Right.
Facebook page as well. Okay. Well, Holly, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. It's been a joy to get to know you.
Sure.
I wish you the best of luck in your position. I presume that you are the assistant state naturalist because you're being groomed to be the actual state naturalist. Let's knock on wood and hope that that's the case.
If they'll have me, we'll see.
Okay. Randy will have to retire at some point. He's got his face on a beer can. What else can he do?
What's left? No.
Exactly.
He's
Thank you,
joking.
Holly. And be careful out there.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.